Welcome to Oncology Today, the use of targeted therapy in the management of thyroid cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Marcia Brose, the Director of Cancer Services at Jefferson Health Northeast at the Cindy Kimmel Cancer Center in Philadelphia. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a corresponding video program with Dr. Brose's slide presentation. To begin, I asked her to comment on the different subtypes of thyroid cancer and the natural history and presentation of the disease. So, to begin, can you just provide a little bit of a snapshot of management of thyroid cancer from the point of view of the medical oncologist? What are the different subtypes of thyroid cancer? And generally, what's the natural history and when is the medical oncologist typically getting involved?
So there are three types of thyroid cancer that are treated in three different pathways, you could say. The worst is anaplastic thyroid cancer. This is very, very rare. And those patients usually need surgery and they need to have external beam radiation. There's no question that that is the best therapy. And even in patients who've had it, were able to be resected, sometimes you can actually get some very long-lived responses. If you get lucky and the surgery happened early enough, the anaplastic was picked up when it was sort of still in the thyroid. But you would give everybody radiation for that, and then they get chemotherapy. So they end up with a medical oncologist early on getting treated, usually with combined radiation and chemotherapy. And then they also get genetic testing, because if they have BRAF inhibitors, dabrafenib and trametinib was FDA approved for these patients if they have progression. And people are using that in all settings. Sometimes they're using it in the neoadjuvant setting or earlier on. I haven't seen any patient that was successfully treated neoadjuvantly. And because I think radiation really does have the biggest impact, I try to get patients on that quickly and upfront. And then I usually go with the dabrafenib if it's BRAF mutant. Otherwise, we're doing chemotherapy following that.
Before we get on to medullary, anything new and exciting in anaplastic immunotherapy, for example?
So there are trials ongoing with immunotherapy. Right now, we do not have any new results since the dabrafenib-trametinib approval a couple of years ago. And that really is just for the BRAF positive ones. It's about a third of the patients.
Have objective responses been observed with checkpoint inhibitors?
No, not to the point that I'm aware of. I mean, I think there's still information that's going to be gotten from the combination trials where putting the checkpoint inhibitors together with, say, lenvatinib or other agents. So those trials are ongoing. They're hard to accrue to because of the rarity of the disease. But we haven't really had the panacea of the checkpoint inhibitors, unfortunately, in anaplastic the way we've had it in other cancers. I would still try it in anaplastic. I wouldn't let somebody go without giving that a try, but I'd certainly do the dabrafenib, trametinib up front. And I would try lenvatinib together with the checkpoint inhibitors. And you do the genetic testing, I want to point out, because there are sometimes RET and track fusions that have dedifferentiated into anaplastic. So the first thing I should be saying is you're doing that genotyping for all thyroid cancer patients up front who need systemic therapy, no question. Now moving to medullary thyroid cancer. Medullary thyroid cancer, the main thing you need to know and the oncologist needs to know is that about 50% of patients will present with more advanced disease and they'll have either distant or locally advanced disease and they'll end up needing systemic therapy. Again, testing is the most important, but the most common is the RET point mutation. So you could do a very focused, if that was all you could do, and you could only get like a quick PCR test done, doing that on the tumor is probably the first thing you would do. Nowadays, because of cost, I think a lot of people are still able to look at full panels to see if there are other mutants present. And the reason I say that is there are prognostic mutations like NRAS that can show that a patient has a more aggressive disease. So there still is a role for doing panel-based testing, but the main thing you're looking for in medullary upfront is the RET point mutation. Okay, so differentiating that. Point mutations in medullary thyroid cancer, fusions are found in differentiated thyroid cancer. So now we're focusing on the point mutations. Over half of the patients will have a RET point mutation. Those patients are definitely eligible for getting either selpercatinib or pralsetinib, which are FDA approved in the last couple of years. If they don't have that, they are still eligible for vedotinib or cabozantinib, both of which have good activity in patients in the rest of the medullary. And actually, I should point out, in all medullaries. So there are patients who have point mutations in RET, get treated with a RET inhibitor, and if they start progressing, they're still eligible for vendetinib and cabozantinib because those are approved for all patients. They're multikinase inhibitors for all medullary thyroid cancer patients.
And do you see tumor, anti-tumor activity in that situation?
In those cases, we see very good anti-tumor activity. So in the cases of the selective RET inhibitors, we're seeing response rates over 60% and sometimes over 70%. So really spectacular responses. The selective RET inhibitors are also better tolerated, and that's the reason why I tend to use them first if the patient's a candidate. If they're not a candidate or they've failed that therapy, they still are eligible for vendetinib and cabozantinib. They still have responses, and they can get responses up to 20% of the time or even 30% of the time. So they're not insignificant responses. Slightly higher toxicity profiles are accompanying the multikinase inhibitors, but those are still very, very good agents for medullary thyroid cancer.
So do you see responses in patients who progressed on first-line selective RET inhibitors?
Yeah, you do. So you're able to treat them in the second line. Now, I'll point out, we don't have a large number of those patients yet because many of the people who are on the original trials for the RET inhibitors are still responding. So there's only been a handful of patients I have. The other thing that I would point out in all of our mutation testing is that if they had either a RET fusion or a RET point mutation or a TRK fusion, and they start to respond, a good thing for the medical oncologist to do is to try to actually biopsy one of the lesions at the time of progression. So say they respond for a while and they progress. Getting DNA or RNA from that progressing lesion may actually show a new mutation that's causing resistance. That's important because we actually already have drugs that target the TRK-resistant point mutations that are developing. And I expect we'll have the same for the RET point mutations. There are actually some trials going on right now. And so for that reason, whenever we're thinking about these selective inhibitors, if we have progression, we should also be thinking DNA or RNA-based NGS again to see if we can get sequencing that would show usually their point mutations that are the cause for resistance in both cases.
So you're saying that they start out with a fusion and then they have a point mutation on top of that?
Correct. So the fusion patients can develop a point mutation that causes resistance to the highly selective inhibitors. So again, the oncologist needs to be somewhat versed in genetic testing, that you do it once in the beginning to determine eligibility, then you do it at the time of progression to determine whether or not there's a resistance mutation.
So oncologists are also used to, for example, in lung cancer, doing liquid biopsies, including doing liquid biopsies on relapse to look for resistance mechanisms. Is that applicable in thyroid cancer?
Unfortunately, we haven't had as much success with liquid biopsies. So you can certainly send them off. And I know many physicians like to because there's quick turnaround time. The problem is that thyroid cancer does not shed the DNA and RNA to the same degree that lung cancer does. So you can certainly do it both at the time of diagnosis to see whether or not they're eligible because they have a TRK fusion or TRK point mutation. You can do it again at progression to detect whether or not they have a resistance mutation. The problem is that if that's negative, you can't stop there, because it's just not a sensitive test. You have to assume that if it's negative, there's a chance that it just wasn't shedding, and therefore you need to go back to get tissue, either from the original cancer at the time of starting systemic therapy or from a progressing lesion when we're looking at resistant mechanisms.
In general, and I don't know whether you can make this kind of generalization, but does targeted therapy in thyroid cancer generally follow the same sort of clinical paradigm that you see in lung cancer? In other words, most patients respond. They often respond for a long time, a year at least, but they also pretty much always relapse. Is that paradigm apply to thyroid?
Well, so far it does. I mean, there's still people on those first trials that haven't progressed yet. So we really don't know whether or not everybody's going to progress. There certainly have been half of the patients have progressed at this point, and we're trying to figure out what resistant mechanisms are there, especially with working out the RET inhibitor track. We know a little bit more. It's further along. So yes, I think we can expect that for at least half the patients, but we still don't know whether some of those long-term responses, duration of responses or PFS, are going to turn into be extremely long. Of course, way too early to say whether or not they're actual cures.
Yeah, and you have presented a case in your presentation of a patient who stopped therapy and did not progress. So maybe we will see prolonged responses. I mean, you see that actually in melanoma, I think, with BRAF. Even though it's targeted therapy, some of these people seem to have very prolonged responses. You see that in thyroid too.
Yeah, we do. And I'll say about the TRAC fusions that are really interesting is that a lot of the other cancers that have TRAC fusions have actually led to cures because it allowed for a neoadjuvant approach. So the other place where are sarcomas that have TRAC fusions at a high, high rate. And they're actually children now who have had limb-sparing surgery that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise because they've been able to so drastically shrink the tumor. And what's amazing is when they went in to do the surgery, there was no tumor there.
Wow.
So this is having life-saving, life-altering consequences on so many levels. But I think all of us can really feel excited when we see the kids that now don't have to have amputations and things for sarcoma. But that kind of drastic responses, we're seeing patients who had lungs filled with metastasis that are getting complete responses. Like, it's one thing to say, oh, that you have a complete response when you only had one site of disease and it's 1-2 centimeter lesion. It's another thing when half of the lung volume is filled up with metastasis and those are all gone too. Pretty exciting stuff with these selective inhibitors.
It does sound, at least in some cases, fundamentally different than, I mean, actually, I guess you could say endocrine therapy breast cancer was the first targeted therapy. And people always viewed that as sort of a cytostatic thing that never would cure anybody. But maybe that doesn't apply to all forms of targeted therapy.
Yep, exactly. It definitely doesn't. I think we're really in a new era for what we can do with targeted therapy. So, of course, my background is also in genetics. So I'm like in heaven with all of these therapies. It's everything that I train for both in my PhD work as well as in my clinical work. So I really think its time has come.
Anything else you want to say about medullary?
I think for medullary, the most important thing for people to know is you have to test both the somatic and the germline because you'll miss half of the patients who are eligible for these amazing therapies if you're not actually looking at the tissue.
But if you do tissue, are you going to miss anything in terms of germline? I mean, I know you're not going to diagnose germline, but are you going to miss it?
So if you do the tissue first, you'll pick up all the germline mutations. What you won't know is whether or not that germline mutation exists in the rest of the cells of the body and therefore whether it's hereditary. And so those are the patients you need to also check their blood. If you find it in the blood also, then you've got a germline mutation and those patients need to have genetic counseling for themselves and their blood relatives.
So how about the bulk of thyroid cancer differentiated disease?
So for differentiated thyroid cancer, I think the main thing, again, is first of all, making sure patients are AI refractory and progressing, because as I said, 90% of our patients will be cured by the surgeon's efforts and even radioactive iodine. So when they have a patient that is progressing following radioactive iodine and has metastatic disease, then it's important to know what the choices are. So first and foremost, test, test, test. I prefer to do RNA-based next-generation sequencing because it will give me all of the fusions that are important in this tumor type. And so we would send that out. We'd find out whether or not the tumor has it. Again, this is not germline, so you have to go to the tumor. It doesn't get put into the blood a lot, so I can send off a liquid biopsy, but that's not going to be able to rule out the possibility. So we always check and make sure that they don't have any kind of somatic TRAC or RET fusions. And then we go ahead and plan their therapy. If they have a TRAC or RET fusion, we start them on the selective TRAC inhibitors, which are larotrectinib and entrectinib, or the selective RET inhibitors, which are pralsetinib and selpercatinib. If they do not have a RET fusion, we start them on lenvatinib or sorafenib. And I think based on some of the new overall survival data showing a benefit in the older patients and other subsequent data, I think many people are choosing lenvatinib. There's some sets of patients where you wouldn't necessarily choose lenvatinib. If you're worried about invasive disease, you might want to go more gently in a slower response rate, meaning like speed of response with something like sorafenib or lower dose. Then those patients, all patients after that would then get, in my clinic, are getting cabozantinib based on the results of the randomized phase 3 data that was presented at ASCO 2021, which showed that following either lenvatinib or sorafenib, cabozantinib is a highly active agent with a good progression-free survival and also a very good response rate as well. And it was a positive study based on a hazard ratio of 0.22 in the progression-free survival. So now that can be either third line for the patients who started with pralsetinib or selpercatinib, then go to lenvatinib after that, and then go to cabozantinib. So that tends to be my 1, 2, 3 or 1 and 2 for those patients in differentiated thyroid cancer. I get a lot of people who ask me, well, why aren't you treating with a BRAF inhibitor? That's a selective inhibitor. Why aren't you doing that up front? And there are two reasons. First of all, is that the data for that is weaker. There's only phase 2 data, and it was mostly single institution data. One of it was my data from Penn on vemurafenib in 2012 and data that came out of MD Anderson in 2019. And that data shows response rates that are back down in the 20 to 30% rate. So the rates do not exceed what we're seeing right now with lenvatinib and cabozantinib. And for that reason, even if they have a BRAF mutation, I tend to not use that unless they really can't tolerate the prior agents or they have already failed the other agents. Because even though it's a selective agent, both vemurafenib and dabrafenib still have adverse events. And I don't find that they are necessarily that much improved that would justify me using a BRAF inhibitor before, say, lenvatinib in the first line setting.
Going back to cabozantinib and the COSMIC 311 study that you were talking about presented at ASCO, I don't know, maybe it's because it's earlier or a small number of patients, but I was really kind of surprised by the efficacy of cabozantinib and the curve. Cabozantinib's used in a lot of other solid tumors and even has some efficacy, but this, I don't know, it looks like there's a plateau there. Am I reading this right?
It is very, very early. Remember, the vast majority of patients still had only been on for about 6 months. And in the progression-free survival analysis, we included all patients who had been put on. So the people, at most, they had been on for at least 6 months or around 6 months, but then other patients had only been on for less than 6 months. So what I would do is refer you to the ESMO data, which will give you updated progression-free survival analysis, updated overall survival analysis. I don't think you'll be disappointed. And I will say that I think cabozantinib is definitely here to stay for differentiated thyroid cancer as well.
Is it being looked at in the first line setting?
Not currently. I did a phase 2 data in the first line setting, and we're working on putting that data together just so that people have it. I don't think we're going to have a randomized first line data set because we don't really need it. It's available. If people don't tolerate lenvatinib, they certainly can do cabozantinib. So I'm not sure it would really be a great value added to do a registration trial against the first line.
We hear different things about cabo, again, in different cancers in terms of tolerability. Maybe a lot of it has to do with dosing. How is it dosed in thyroid, and what's your clinical experience, and what's the data on its tolerability?
So the data on the tolerability are very similar to, say, prior renal cell analyses. So it's dosed at 60 milligrams. So it's dosed lower than the original medullary. Unfortunately, I think that cabozantinib got a bad reputation because the first dose was a lot higher and patients did very well. And remember, this trial, patients started at 60 milligrams. There's a bit of an art to managing side effects with cabozantinib. And so I'd say right away, you'll find out when you start a patient on 60 milligrams, whether that's best or whether they do better on 40. But what I find very interesting with cabo, which I do not see with lenvatinib or sorafenib, is that it seems like it has sort of like a cumulative toxicity effect. So first of all, just let me say upfront that there were no new safety signals. It was tolerable and they were manageable in virtually all cases. And the tolerability really was quite good. But what I want to point out is that my patients who have been on cabozantinib, they may go a year and tolerate, say, 40 or 60, and then they sort of get what I call the dwindles. They start to kind of slow down. Mostly the first thing they notice is fatigue, but they might get diarrhea and other symptoms. Usually if I give them a holiday, sometimes up to a month, they don't grow back, and then I start them again at a dose lower. They then do well on that dose, maybe for another year, and then I'll dose reduce them again. And using that kind of approach, I've had patients on cabozantinib with medullary and differentiated thyroid cancer out over 3 years. But I'll tell you that sometimes before I ever give up on the cabozantinib due to toxicity, they might be on 20 milligrams every other day dosing. And so in the phase three trial, we did design it so that down the line, we'll be able to do an amendment and add that dosing level in if we find that patients are really getting down to 20 milligram daily dose. Because I found that even every other day dosing, once you got down to that level, could still keep people in good shape. And the other thing that we're going to try to capture with the COSMIC 311 study is this idea of what happens. So say you have a patient who's responded beautifully for 2 or 3 years, but had to go off because of toxicity. Interestingly, if you just follow them with serial CT scans every 2 or 3 months, I've had patients go 3 years before their cancers figured out how to grow again. They're not cured. They do have recurrence again, and it does come back. But what a great 3 years they can get. That's something that seems to be, for me, in my hands, somewhat unique to cabozantinib. I haven't seen that. I call it the coasting effect. I haven't actually been able to coast my lenvatinib or sorafenib patients. Most of those patients, when I stop therapy, they grow right away. And remember, when the patients got on cabo, they're more advanced patients. They are rapidly progressing. I mean, you see the PFS in the placebo arm of 1.9 months. These are not like quiet patients. So anybody who has that idea that a thyroid cancer is a nicely easy to treat cancer can't be thinking that once it's progressed on any other therapy. By then it's become more aggressive and you have to be expecting a much more rapid rise. And cabozantinib seems to be the perfect drug position to capture that response, slow things down, and even maybe turn back the clock a little bit on the aggressiveness of the tumor.
Any speculations on how that occurs? It kind of has an immune flavor, and yet I'm not aware that immune therapy is that helpful in thyroid cancer.
I'm not sure if it's an immune thing or it's not. I mean, we haven't had good immune responses in thyroid cancer. I think it more has to do with how effectively it affects the signaling in the cancer and shuts down some of that active signaling. It's a very broad multikinase inhibitor, and it hits, in addition to VEGF receptor inhibitor, it hits PDGF, it hits EGF, it hits so many things that I think that it has more to do with the fact that it effectively blankets a lot of the kinase signaling. And it takes a while for that cancer cell to start making proteins again and signaling again through those pathways. So I just feel like it's more that we hit it over the head just that much harder and completely.
That's really interesting. When you were saying after 1 year, you have to dose reduce, and then the next year, this cumulative concept you're talking about. And I was thinking, have I heard that story in other cancers? But I don't think I hear people being on treatment for 3 years. So we don't know. It kind of reminds me, I remember a few years ago, we were talking about sorafenib when that was coming in. And you were telling me about the muscle wasting they have after prolonged treatment. And again, we weren't hearing that story with sorafenib because people weren't on it that long. I wanted to get an update too on first-line therapy, not just sorafenib, but also lenvatinib. Of course, lenvatinib, we hear lots of stories in other cancers, HCC, hepatocellular, endometrial, dosing issues, side effects, hypertension, diarrhea. Same story in thyroid?
Yes, but one of the things I want to point out to all the medical colleagues who treat other cancers, if you really want to know how to manage the side effects of all of these kinase inhibitors, talk to the thyroid cancer oncologist, because we have them in patients for years. So we know how to manage the side effects, whether it's diarrhea, using aggressive Imodium regimens, similar to some of the oxaliplatin and some of the other cancer agents that have really bad diarrhea, watery diarrhea. We're giving very aggressive Imodium in the same setting. So we do that. We actually have our patients, the muscle wasting you brought up, patients do have muscle wasting with a multikinase inhibitor, and I think that's directly related to an effective inhibition of VEGF receptor in the muscles, which leads to the sarcopenia. And what we can find is that if you can get a patient to go to the gym and lift weights, you can directly counter that effect. And I've had patients who have taken me seriously. I'm not joking when I tell them to go and lift weights. Those patients do better. And what I find fascinating, Neil, is the fact that when you do that, not only do they not lose muscle mass, but they don't have as much trouble with diarrhea. Then they don't lose as much weight and their appetite is better. And I don't know whether it's that when they're in a catabolic state and they're breaking down muscle mass, if that doesn't actually exacerbate all of those other toxicities. And when you can control that and you make sure that they're not losing the muscle mass, it just seems to promote the better eating And then the better eating promotes the diarrhea not being as bad. Like, it's all interrelated. Who knows which comes first, except to say that if you keep your muscle mass and you do good strength training, you have the best chance, I think, of not having the worst of those other side effects.
So interesting. What's the starting dose of lenvatinib?
So the starting dose of lenvatinib is 24 milligrams, but there was data that's been presented and we're in the process of getting it published that looked at whether or not 24 milligrams was as efficacious as starting at 18 milligrams. And the reason for it was that because of the hypertension that's found with 24 milligrams in elderly patients, people were worried about starting patients at 24 milligrams. So we randomized patients between 24 and 18. And I want to point out something really important about this study. It was a blinded study. So the physicians and the patients couldn't be prejudiced as to what was happening in their bodies. And they objectively managed everybody the same. If they had a side effect, they managed it. If they had to dose reduce, they dose reduced according to the same schedule. And what was fascinating is that we found out two things that I think were surprising. The first is that it's not as efficacious. The response rate is statistically lower if you start patients at a lower dose. So that showed us that they were not equivalent. And so that was the first thing. I guess that's not such a big surprise. We might have been able to anticipate that. Although I would tell you that the physicians who give this drug were thinking that it was just as good. It clearly wasn't as good and has now been proven objectively. But the second part of the equation is where the big surprise came in, because it turned out that they were both equally likely to lead to grade 3 events. Now, there was a little bit more need for dose reduction in the higher dose, in the 24 milligram starting dose. But interestingly, if you had an involved physician that was managing the patient identically, they weren't more likely to have a grade 3 event. So basically, what we've shown is that 24 milligrams works better than 18 milligrams, and yet it's not statistically significantly worse as far as toxicity goes. And there's going to be additional data presented at ESMO that goes to looking at actually patient-reported outcomes. So I can't give that away, but to say that that is also sort of the third part of this story that I think is important. So at least at this point, the starting dose for lenvatinib should be 24 milligrams in all cases, with very rare exceptions when there's a significant concern of a comorbidity, but it really should be 24 milligrams.
And where do people usually land?
So interestingly, most patients are landing now between around 18 or 14 milligrams. I mean, over 50% of the patients at 24 milligrams will get dose reduced at least once. And there is still a number of people who get dose reduced from 18 milligrams down to 14. So they will get dose reduced once or twice, but usually they do pretty well. But what I guess we can interpret from that data is that that initial kick, that initial 24 dose is actually having an effective, statistically different effect in silencing or shrinking that tumor. And so by not giving the patient, even if it's only for 2 months, that higher dose, we're actually going to give them a worse outcome. And I think for that reason, we need to do 24 milligrams.
So let's just spend the rest of our time chatting about molecularly targeted therapy for advanced thyroid cancer, and particularly what's new and exciting. Maybe we can start out with patients with RET fusions, endpoint mutations.
So in differentiated thyroid cancer, the excitement is all about RET fusions. Most importantly, we have to remember that as a molecular oncologist now, you have to get an NGS RNA-based assay, and that's the only way you're going to pick up a gene fusion. When you do that, if you have either a TRK fusion or a RET fusion, you're now eligible for these really great, highly selective kinase inhibitors. The TRK fusion inhibitors are larotrectinib and entrectinib, both FDA approved in thyroid cancer. And the RET fusions are selpercatinib and pralsetinib, both FDA approved for differentiated thyroid cancer. So we now have these really, really great therapies. Tolerability, really many, many fewer grade threes, primarily grade 1 and 2, very good tolerability and response rates around 70%. So I think that we really have a great option. And I usually use them in the first line for patients who are eligible. As for molecularly targeted agents in medullary thyroid cancer, the big name of the game there still is RET. But in this case, in medullary thyroid cancer, we're looking for RET point mutations. Those are present in over 60%. So you definitely do not want to miss any of those. It's important that you get the testing on the somatic, on the tissue, if liquid biopsy is negative or if they're not germline positive, because you'll miss half of them if you don't actually test the tissue. For that reason, and because time is of the essence, I tend to test the tissue first. If it's positive, then I go back and check the blood to see whether or not they have an hereditary RET mutation. But I can't emphasize enough, RET is the name of the game in medullary thyroid cancer. These new inhibitors are really fantastic. Response rates in the 70% range, plus or minus, depending on whether it's first line or second line. They even work after the multikinase inhibitors. So it doesn't matter when you found out. Maybe you've had somebody who's been on vedetinib for 5 years and progresses. But if they have a mutation, you need to find that out, because now they're also eligible for these really great new therapies.
What about choice of targeted therapy, for example, with RET, selpercatinib versus pralsetinib? Is this sort of an anastrozole, letrozole, you can't tell a difference, or more like what we see, let's say, with PARP inhibitors, where they really are very different?
So I think there's minimal differences, but if you look at the differences between the kinomes, you'll see that selpercatinib is a little bit more narrowly targeted. And I think there is some effect of the inhibition that spills over into JAK2 inhibition from the pralsetinib. I've had a little bit more bone marrow toxicity. So I tend to pick selpercatinib first. There are going to be possibly countries that have one or the other. So then, of course, you would use whichever one is available. But I tend to pick selpercatinib first, but there's not really good data to say why you would do one or the other. It's just that bone marrow toxicity, I think, has been swaying me a little bit more towards selpercatinib.
So what about brain mets in thyroid cancer? Do you see it? And how do these drugs do in the brain?
So interestingly, about 10% of patients with advanced metastatic disease will develop brain mets. And it turns out that all of these agents seem to have activity in the brain. And I'll say that even the multikinase inhibitors I've seen have activity in the brain, even though that wasn't something that we looked at specifically in the trials. But these have been reported from the clinical trials of the highly selective inhibitors. And for that reason, sometimes now with our patients, we don't necessarily do Gamma Knife. If they have a very small 2 to 5 millimeter lesion in the head, they're not symptomatic and they're going to get systemic therapy, I'll go right ahead and start them on selpercatinib, because I know that that brain metastasis is going to get treated. And of course, if anything happened or they got symptomatic, I certainly could go back and do Gamma Knife afterwards. Now, for most of the multikinase inhibitor trials, patients had already received radiation before they got the inhibitors, but I still think there's some activity there as well. But we don't have quite as good data, I think, in that setting, just because of the way patients were treated at the time.
It's funny. It seems like a dream, but 7 o'clock this morning, we actually did a webinar on targeted therapy of lung cancer with Alex Drillin, Ross Kamage, and Justin Gaynor. And we were talking a lot about RET. And we were also talking about the paradigm of CNS mets, which you were just referring. I mean, in lung, it's gotten standard. Oncologists typically will try to use systemic therapy. Have you seen good responses in the brain to these agents?
Yeah. I haven't always seen what the measurements were, but they clearly are responding and they definitely don't grow. We're going to go back and actually see. We do have data that says that selpercatinib patients have a very good response rate if they have brain metastasis, but that's still using their basic RECIST criteria. And so we've actually talked about both in TRACK and in the RET trials, going back and seeing exactly how much were those lesions shrinking. But clearly, they weren't going to have long progression-free survivals if those were growing. So at a minimum, we're getting good stabilization.
So what about TRK fusion patients? Again, we have larotrectinib and entrectinib. At this point, can you differentiate them at all? And can you talk a little bit about the incidence of TRK in thyroid and where these agents fit in?
TRK fusions, undifferentiated thyroid cancer, is present in about 5 to 25 or 35% of patients. I'll point out that it's much more common to find them in an adolescent. So people who are seeing thyroid cancer in anybody, say, under 20, I would definitely be thinking right away TRK fusions. Actually, RET fusions are more common in the adolescents as well. What's really great about larotrectinib and the TRK fusions in those patients is that they also do extremely well. Patients' response rates have been, again, around 70%. sometimes even higher. And so differentiated thyroid cancer and larotrectinib are a really great combination. Now, the entrectinib data is much more limited. They enrolled many fewer thyroid cancer patients. It's still FDA approved. It still had a nice profile. But I think that for toxicity reasons, again, laro being a little bit more of the narrowly targeted agent, we tend to go with that. The other interesting thing is we actually already have the LOXO-195 agent, which is being developed for patients who have resistant mutations in TRK. So the TRK program is a little bit further along as far as understanding. And I think they're also sequencing the resistant mutations that are coming with entrectinib, and they're similar. So basically, the TRK gene develops somewhat regular point mutations when it has resistance. And right now in clinical trials, we have second generation trials going on that are looking at targeting patients who had resistance mutations come up. It's still better than chemotherapy for sure. And it's certainly better than some of the multikinase inhibitors. The next generations of the resistant targeted therapies in clinical trials, my understanding from the early data is that they are a little bit more toxic. So they're not quite as free of the toxicities that we've seen in larotrectinib and entrectinib. But it is an interesting, interesting field, and it continues to march forward, which is great for the patients.
What kind of toxicities do you see with these NTRK inhibitors?
So the biggest one I see is dizziness. So that tends to be the most sort of life-altering. So patients cannot get around if they're dizzy all the time. Now, I usually let them go for about a month or two, tell them not to drive, and tell me if it gets better, because sometimes they acclimate a little bit to it. If they do, then we stay at the full dose. If not, sometimes we've had to dose reduce patients on the basis of dizziness. The other one, it seems like there is a little bit of what we're calling a withdrawal syndrome. So interestingly, TRK inhibitors were originally developed as pain management drugs. So they actually suppress the pain receptors in the brain. What happens is if the levels get too low before the next dose, it seems like there can be a little bit of an augmentation of pain, sometimes in places where the patient has had maybe some arthritis, or maybe they just feel general pain. The point is that that can sometimes kick in a little bit before. Sometimes my patients have to play a little bit with the timing of their dose. Sometimes in the afternoon, they're taking their second dose a little bit before the 12-hour mark in order just to, because if they take the medicine, that goes away. I have had some colleagues who said that if they stop the drug, restart it at a lower dose, they can also get rid of that pain withdrawal effect. So we're still working on how to actually best manage that, but it's something to be aware of.
Wow, that pain thing, that's interesting. I never heard of that. Again, this morning that they brought up the dizziness thing, and they actually drew the analogy to erlotinib, you know, the new drug that's used with ALK, where they see these CNS, like they see personality changes and stuff like this. So it's basically a direct effect in the brain then.
Yes, clearly. And
that's what the dizziness is.
Clearly. And so larotrectinib and entrectinib, so TRK receptors are present in the CNS. That's why they were originally developed as pain management drugs. That's just specific for larotrectinib and entrectinib. In some of the other selective inhibitors that target RET, for instance, thankfully you haven't needed RET since you were an embryo. So there's a little bit more ability to not have those side effects with the RET selective inhibitors. It really is specific to the TRK pathway.
So the last thing I was going to ask you about is, it's a lot more difficult for a general oncologist when they're dealing with a tumor they don't see as much. Lung cancer, they see almost as many patients as investigators, breast, et cetera. Thyroid, now it's a little bit different. And I'm sure you see a lot of second opinions of people who've been managed by general medical oncologists. Any, I'm not going to say mistakes, but maybe myths or misperceptions about thyroid cancer in general and molecularly targeted therapy specifically that you see?
Well, I think that we're still in an era where I would highly recommend that thyroid cancer still get to somebody who treats these regularly. I can't emphasize enough that, remember what we said, I may have mentioned this in another discussion that we've had, that the patients who've been on these drugs the longest have been thyroid cancer patients. And the people who have the experience with helping manage these effects over a long term are the thyroid cancer docs. The biggest mistake I see is that people who don't give them as often tend to be very, very quick to decrease the doses because they don't know how to manage the side effects. And then the biggest one that breaks my heart is, oh, doc, I can't have that drug. I progressed on it. Well, sometimes I have time to say, well, I'm not so sure you really got a good chance at this. Let's try again. unfortunately, sometimes by the time they come for the second opinion, it's too late. We can't double check. We have to go on to another agent. So it's really important still, I think, for these people to get to highly specialized centers. And there's a handful of us across the states. And I think that it's really, really important that they get treated, if at all possible, by somebody who does it all the time. If not, I think the person who is referred to for the second opinion still be part of the treatment plan and see the patients periodically. Maybe there's a travel involved. I have patients who are getting treated in Florida and other places. They still come up and see me two or three times a year with the point of making sure that they're on track. If there's any other information I need to give them about how to better manage their side effects, I can still help. But I think that the care really should be being directed still from the centers that specialize in advanced thyroid cancer care.
It's interesting you're mentioning the issue of traveling, but people have a pretty different view of travel than they did 2 years ago. And I've been thinking for a long time that I feel like there should be more connection between investigators who see stuff all the time that people in practice see once a year. And it never really happened to the extent that I thought was possible. But I wonder now that people are accepting telemedicine more, maybe we would have more connection to investigators.
Exactly. We do. We definitely do. And I think that also to the people who are in the expert centers, you can do telemedicine visits. I have somebody in North Carolina that I've been managing for a few years that way. The problem I will say is telemedicine is good only so far. And remember, we're talking about toxicities, and I can't totally appreciate necessarily how a patient's doing when I don't see them walk into the room and how much they're using a cane and how much they're using, like, that one look is worth $1 million. And honestly, I can almost tell everything I need to know in the first minute of an in-person visit. I had some patients who had, for instance, some sacral decubes I didn't know about, and we missed them on telemedicine until they end up needing to go to the hospital. So those are the kind of things that I would have noticed when they sat down gingerly in the chair and things like that. So telemedicine is helpful, and I'm so glad we've developed it. It does usually require that at least one, in my opinion, should require at least one in-person visit, because I don't think you can get a really good idea from that doctor. And even still, you have to assume that they're only getting 80 to 90% of the picture.
Of course, 80 to 90% is way better than nothing, which is what happens, I guess, most of the time. But it's interesting too, though, in a way, we did a really interesting program a few weeks ago on AML where we had the doc taking care of the patient. We had an investigator, this is all on Zoom, and they would present cases, and then we brought the patient into the Zoom meeting.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And it was just for education purposes, but it was an interesting exercise because first we heard about the patient, and we have this mental image, and then they come on the screen and you get that sort of eyeball test and go, wow, they're really in great shape. They've already had a transplant, et cetera. So I still think there might be more potential to network people together.
Well, we should do one of those programs for thyroid cancer for sure, because I think especially the idea of what a patient can tell you and the doctor can tell you about the partnership that goes into managing these patients successfully over a long period of time. I've got a couple of really great patients that we could use for that, that are very articulate and could really teach people something about what that experience is like.
I'm not trying to oversell telemedicine, but the other thing is you can really evaluate people more frequently. It's not the huge hassle coming down to the medical center, finding parking, et cetera. You can check in on them every week if you need to, if you need to see their skin lesion, et cetera.
The only thing is you have to make sure that what you need to treat them for weekly. So I can do that, say, with lenvatinib because I'm using blood pressure, right? So I have to make sure that their blood pressure cuff is accurate, that they know how to do it, and that they're charting it well. Then I think that's a great example of something. When you really have a single toxicity that you're monitoring for, a patient can do their blood pressure check and then you can have a discussion with them over the phone. That is a great example of that.
Subsequent to this recording, on September 17th, 2021, the FDA approved cabozantinib for the treatment of advanced RAI refractory differentiated thyroid cancer that has progressed on prior VEGF-targeted treatment based on the results of the COSMIC 311 study. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Brose, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.